Welcome to Meet the Professors, Clinical Investigator Perspectives on the Current and Future Management of Multiple Myeloma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this roundtable discussion, which is a spinoff from a webinar series we did this past year in multiple myeloma in partnership with the University of South Florida Office of Continuing Professional Development, I met with three clinical investigators who participated in the webinar series, Dr. Sergio Giralt, Jonathan Kaufman, and Peter Voorhees. As with all of the webinars in this series, we had general medical oncologists presenting cases via video, and in this program, it included Drs. Neil Morgenstein, Ranju Gupta, and Lyle Feinstein. The cases presented by these physicians form the framework for our discussion. All three of you are participating in the webinar series that we've had over this past year in myeloma. As you recall, we had three general medical oncologists, Dr. Gupta from Pennsylvania, Dr. Feinstein from Miami, and Dr. Morgenstein from New Jersey near you, Sergio. So we're just going to use these cases as a point to get into discussions. And I kind of want to just begin, and I'm going to start with Pete after this. This is a patient who's 75 years old, presented with anemia, and was found to have trisomy 3, 9, and 11. Her PET scan was negative. She was actually treated with Dara-RVD, and she had problems with rash on lenalidomide, and then he tried pomalidomide and just couldn't get it to work. So he had to end up discontinuing that. She had a VGPR after the fourth cycle and was being evaluated for transplant. So I just want to start out with you, Pete, and just with that sort of as a background. First of all, maybe you could chat a little bit about, from your point of view, whether or not the trisomies alter your approach to a patient like this, and basically how you would think through the upfront management of a patient like this.
So the first thing that I would tell a patient who has hyperdiploidy, like this patient does, is that their outcome is going to be very good. I think, you know, we've got very strong data at this point that long-term prognoses with regards to progression-free and overall survival are best for those with hyperdiploidy. The caveat that they don't have, in addition to the standard hyperdiploidy, gain or amplification of chromosome 1q. I think all of the advances that have occurred in the treatment of newly diagnosed multiple myeloma have benefited both standard and high-risk patients, but one could argue to some extent that the standard-risk patients have had the greatest absolute gains in progression-free and overall survival with the advances that we've made. So I think a daratumumab RVD choice for frontline in this particular patient is very good. With regards to their good prognosis in the long term, if they are experiencing toxicity of therapy, you probably have a little bit more elbow room as far as how you modify therapy going forward. So, for example, in this particular case, if there was just no way I could get around the rash caused by the lenalidomide, I might just run with the daratumumab, the bortezomib, and dexamethasone components of the therapy, assuming that the patient is otherwise responding, rather than try and put pomalidomide into the mix at that point.
So, Sergio, another question that Dr. Morgenstein had about this case and comes up every time we talk about myeloma is the current role of transplant, current role of MRD. Does MRD in any way affect the decision about transplant? And, of course, now on top of everything else, we have COVID considerations. So, Sergio, where are we today right now in terms of indications for transplant versus collecting cells and holding off?
So I think the American Society of Hematology meeting this year, even though it was virtual, had a whole session dedicated to autologous transplant for multiple myeloma. And I think there were very instructive abstracts presented there and in the myeloma session. One, we had the long-term follow-up of the CAVL study showing a survival benefit, but the survival benefit was only seen after 8 years. Two, we saw the FORTE trial being presented, and initially when the FORTE trial was presented, there was no definite difference between KRD times 12 versus KRD induction transplant and KRD consolidation. But in this follow-up, interesting, Francesca Gay presented the data, and there's a significant progression-free survival benefit for patients who get KRD then followed by transplant, and then consolidated with KRD. More importantly, the benefit was seen even in patients who were MRD negative. Now, in this case, in Dr. Morgenstein's case, 75 years old, her life expectancy is probably around another 15 to 20 years. So her goal should be good control and deep control over myeloma. And we've seen that MRD negativity makes a difference. So now you have somebody who's had four cycles of a DARA-based induction, is still only in a VGPR. This patient can be converted to MRD negative with high-dose melphalan. And I think, you know, what Jonathan presented at ASH, which was the follow-up of the Griffin study, I mean, that 90% progression-free survival at 2 years is incredible. And that's the combination of the best drugs we have up front, high-dose melphalan consolidation, and then a subsequent consolidation to maintain MRD negativity.
So, Jonathan, any comments about this in terms of transplant? And again, also the role of MRD and whether you think MRD is a reasonable assay for a community-based doc who's not going to put a patient in a trial to utilize in this situation and also in the maintenance situation, trying to decide about whether to give maintenance and for how long.
So there's a lot there. The 75-year-old patient, there's a certain number of 75-year-olds will you'll give DARA-RVD, and that's going to be too much treatment for them. It seems to me like this patient in particular, outside of the rash, it really did okay from an overall performance status perspective. And I want to reiterate and agree with Pete that if somebody really, if we really can't tolerate lenalidomide as part of the upfront therapy because of rash, I also don't switch to pomalidomide. I will carry out the three-drug induction therapy, knowing that in agreement, again, with Sergio here, that I would also take this patient to transplant in first remission, knowing that this patient, while having a VGPR, did not have a very deep remission. I think in our standard induction therapies, there might be some induction therapies where what I'm about to say isn't relevant. But with our current induction therapies, there's very few patients who are going to be MRD negative after four cycles. And so I don't think it helps. It really helps in that situation in the majority of patients. And then the real question, and I brought up by Sergio, I think the two really important studies is what we do after transplant. We know that in standard risk patients, lenalidomide is the standard of care. We now have two studies. The Forte study, again, compared in the maintenance setting, len, carfilzomib versus len alone. And then the Griffin study, really led primarily by Pete, compared len alone to len plus DARA. And both of the studies that had the doublet versus the single had appeared to be improvement. In the Forte study, the improvement was in progression-free survival. And in the Griffin study, looking at DARA-len, it was in increase in MRD negativity. So I think right now we're having a really important discussion is should we be using doublets in everybody? And then you get to the final question of whether we should be using MRD. And I think there's going to be a role of MRD, and it might not be part of the initial decision, but it will be part of the decision we make 2 and 3 years after we've started lenalidomide or after we've started maintenance therapy.
In terms of whether to continue or discontinue.
Right. That's exactly right.
Are there trials right now or incorporating that type of design, Jonathan?
There are. There are trials. There's randomized discontinuation trials. The MRD negative patients, should you continue therapy or not?
So, Pete, one of the questions we get a lot from oncologists, and actually Dr. Morgenstein brought it up also, is what type of MRD testing to do? And maybe you could review the options and what your recommendation is.
Sure. So there's the FDA-approved platform, which is a next-generation sequencing platform. But you also have the next-generation flow cytometry platform as well. From my perspective, both of the assays are able to assess MRD negativity down to the level of 10 to the minus 6. So I actually think that they're both perfectly valid approaches. One of the downsides to the flow-based technique is that you need a large sample and you have to count a large number of marrow cells to get down to 10 to the minus 6th. The other thing is that you need a fresh sample of bone marrow aspirate. So if you're sending it to another center, it's got to be processed very quickly within 24 hours or so. On the other hand, the advantage to the flow-based approach is that it is cheaper and you don't need a baseline sample from which to compare. Whereas with the NGS-based platform, again, which is FDA approved as a prognostic marker in multiple myeloma, that's something that requires both a baseline sample, which in most instances that we can get, it's just more of a logistical hiccup more than anything else. But it does require that baseline sample as well as the follow-up sample. But I think that they actually both have performed very well in prospective studies and have very powerfully shown that achievement of MRD negativity is associated with not just an improvement in progression-free survival, but overall survival. And you see differences at which point you cut off the MRD level of sensitivity. So 10 to the minus 6 clearly does better than 10 to the minus 5, which does better than 10 to the minus 4, et cetera.
So, Sergio, I'm curious about situations where you consider a proteasome inhibitor post-transplant as maintenance. You have situations like with this patient who's having problems tolerating IMiDs. Other situations we'll talk about later in terms of higher risk patients where, for example, a proteasome inhibitor plus an IMiD or lenalidomide would be considered. I'm curious in what situations you bring proteasome inhibitors into the maintenance setting, Sergio, and what your thoughts are about exazimib, because of course, in a longer term, there's a lot of convenience issues being oral. You have the COVID considerations right now. So just curious when you use a proteasome inhibitor in the maintenance setting, Sergio, and what your thoughts are about exazimib.
So I think, Neil, as we personalize treatment to the individual patients that we're seeing, we need to recognize what the risk factors are. And there's one is ISS stage. We know that ISS stage 1 does better than 2 and 3. 2, the cytogenetics. We know that they're high-risk chromosome abnormalities and standard-risk chromosome abnormalities. And then the final one is response to induction therapy. Patients who achieve a complete remission after 4 to 6 cycles of treatment do actually much better than patients who do not achieve a complete remission, particularly if they're MRD negative. So when you put all those three factors together and you decide, what am I going to do to a patient post-transplant? You can go to one extreme saying, well, if I have a patient with stage 1 disease who has tolerated lenalidomide well, probably single agent lenalidomide would be standard of care. And those patients have actually done very well in the follow-up of the CLGP study. Now, on the other hand, if you go to the extreme of a patient with high-risk cytogenetics who did not achieve a CR to induction treatment, and then now is post-transplant, even if they're in an MRD-negative CR, you know that MRD-negative CR is not tantamount to cure. These patients do relapse, and some of them relapse early, particularly if they have high-risk disease. Jonathan mentioned 2 studies regarding consolidation. The studies shown that post-transplant therapies with 2-drug maintenance is better than 1-drug maintenance. Although the Stamina trial looked at continued consolidation with 3 drugs, it did not show a benefit for it. But the other European trial, which looked at consolidation versus going straight to maintenance, did show a benefit. I think in a patient with high-risk disease, that's defined by either stage, chromosome abnormalities, or response to induction therapy, I would do a doublet, either carfilzomib lenalidomide or a daratumumab lenalidomide, after giving 4 more cycles of consolidation, which is the initial induction. Single agent proteasome inhibitor maintenance has been explored initially with bortezomib. The data from the randomized trial suggested some benefit, but I think we all recognize that lenalidomide maintenance is a lot easier. I was not very impressed by the randomized trial of exazimib versus placebo. I think actually the exazimib group didn't do as well as the lenalidomide. Now, that's a cross-trial comparison, but I was not very impressed by the randomized trial of exazimib versus placebo. Now, having said that, we do during COVID, we had patients who we actually were giving consolidation with either bortezomib lenalidomide or carfilzomib lenalidomide, and many of those patients during COVID, we changed to exazimib. But I do think that at least the data would support that lenalidomide or doublets are probably better post-transplant or continued therapy maintenance strategies than a single agent exazimib, despite it being very convenient.
So I want to get Jonathan, your take on this. But before we do, Sergio, you mentioned the issue of COVID, which obviously continues. And I'm wondering what's happened over this past year in terms of transplant and COVID. In the beginning, it seemed like everybody, you know, when this first started, was pulling back from transplant. Then it seemed like maybe there wasn't. Then I wasn't really that clear. What's going on at Memorial from that point of view? And what's your take nationally on how people are adjusting to the issue of COVID, particularly when surges occur in terms of doing transplant, Sergio?
So when we started, New York was hit in the spring. We made a conscious decision of that we would continue to collect cells because our fear was that delaying collection would really reduce the quality of the products we were collecting. But we did make a conscious decision of delaying transplant in patients who had responsive disease. In patients who had suboptimal response to induction, we were taking them to transplant because we believed, and we were right, that delaying them would actually harm them. Gunjan Shah from our institution, together with Susan DeWolf, wrote a paper that came out in Journal Clinical Investigation about the impact on COVID on patients who underwent transplant. And the myeloma societies have recently written various papers that have come out. Getting COVID and having myeloma is not a good thing. It is associated with an increased risk of mortality compared to the regular population. But myeloma doesn't stop for COVID. So we really think that these patients should continue to be treated optimally in the context that if we, our community required hospital resources to be able to deal with the COVID surge, we would be asked to hold back and reduce our transplant activity to be able to assist with the COVID surge. We have not been asked to do that when we are continuing to transplant people. Our feeling is that with social distancing, face mask, and adequate hand washing, the risk of hospital-acquired COVID is very, very small. And you know, our patients social distance naturally, so they really are very careful.
So I want to get back to the issue with you, Jonathan, of the use of proteasometers in the maintenance setting. Can you comment on, again, when you utilize this and what your thoughts are about exazimib, both in terms of COVID connection, but also in terms of efficacy, what we know about it compared to the other proteasome inhibitors?
Now, our high-risk patients starting probably close to 10 years ago, because we were so disappointed with single agent lenalidomide in our high-risk patients, we instituted a three-year program of lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, and published that back in 2014, led by my colleague Jay Nuka. And we continued that and have subsequently published a much larger experience showing with the three-drug maintenance therapy. So standard induction, at this time it was RBD, early autologous transplant, three drugs maintenance therapy for up to 3 years, which primarily was bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone. We had a progression-free survival for a high-risk patient population of 40 months. And we were happy with that in that it was better than what we'd seen previously, but still not up to where we were with standard risk patients. We subsequently changed our approach to be somewhat more aggressive and actually have a clinical trial right now in these high-risk patients with a combination of carfilzomib, pomalidomide, dexamethasone. But outside the context of a clinical trial, we're now doing prolonged therapy with lenalidomide and carfilzomib. And it was, in a large part, it was the Forte study that, again, as Sergio mentioned, had consolidation with four cycles of KRD after autologous transplant, and then had a randomization of KR versus R, and clearly showed, both in the high-risk patient population and the standard-risk patient population, that adding twice-monthly carfilzomib to standard lenalidomide was associated with a progression-free survival advantage. And I think in a large part, it was really supportive of what we had been doing in treating high-risk patients with the combination proteasome inhibitor and IMiD. And we always predicted that the standard-risk patients would also benefit from the combination. It was just in the standard-risk patients, there was a question of as Sergio mentioned, their standards patients can do so well for so long. Did we really need to be that aggressive, even if we could improve outcomes? And so I really like the way that Sergio described it, is that if you have a patient who didn't have a great response to induction therapy and transplant, that's the patient where you would lean more towards combination therapy, in addition to the patients who have high-risk disease, however you define it. And the second question you asked was one of the role of exacerbib. And again, I agree with Sergio that single agent exacerbib, while the study was positive from a statistical standpoint, it was the absolute benefit was quite small. There was a subsequent study in the non-transplant patient that showed a statistical benefit and clinical benefit of exacerbib maintenance versus observation in the non-transplant setting. So I think it's very clearly that's effective. So if we have high-risk patients, we recommend the combination of lenalidomide and a proteasome inhibitor and show that the best data we have now is with carfilzomib. And then we just have some patients who just don't or refuse or can't or make the decision because of COVID come into the infusion center 2 to 3 times a month. And so it's in those patients that as our plan B that we give, are comfortable giving exacerbib. We don't have randomized data comparing exacerbib, len maintenance, carfilzomib len maintenance, bortezomib len maintenance. But in those patients where we absolutely think a proteasome inhibitor is important, but we can't get them to come to the infusion center, then exacerbib is what we'll use.
So Pete, let's go back to the Griffin trial. And I'd like you to summarize from your point of view, what you think the key points are for a general medical oncologist to know about in terms of that study, and particularly in the standard risk situation, what your thoughts are about utilizing it outside a trial setting right now. A lot of people are doing, a lot of the investigators in this series are doing it. And it also kind of ties in, I think, with a general, you know, when you think about medical oncologists, they're hearing things from breast cancer people, other people, where you don't always have the same philosophy that you all do in myeloma. You know, you remember the old iceberg graphic that Jonathan's colleague Sagar has, and this idea that drive the tumor down as far as you can. Whereas in other non-curative situations in oncology, breast cancer, for example, they try to minimize the amount of therapy. So can you talk a little bit about the Griffin study and in particular what your thoughts are about utilizing that approach in the standard risk patient?
So this was a randomized phase 2 study that basically took an RVD-based platinum-eligible multiple myeloma patients. So the standard of care arm received 4 3-week cycles of induction RVD therapy, followed by MEL 200 auto. When they recovered, they got 2 3-week cycles of RVD post-transplant consolidation, and then they went on to single-agent lenalidomide maintenance therapy until disease progression. In the DARA arm, they got the exact same thing, but in the induction, daratumumab was actually given weekly for those 12 weeks of induction therapy. It was given on day 1 of the 2 post-transplant consolidation cycles. And then it was given once every 4 weeks during maintenance for the first 2 years of maintenance. And then patients were encouraged to continue on lenalidomide monotherapy until disease progression. So as I think we're thinking about using this in standard clinical practice, I always say when in Rome, do what the Romans do. So if you want to replicate the positive results that we saw in Griffin, you need to kind of stick with the script, assuming that patients are tolerating it well. And what we showed in that study, whether you looked at the end of induction therapy, at the end of post-transplant consolidation, or as Jonathan updated us at ASH back in December, at the end of 1 year of maintenance therapy, the depth of response does continue to improve in both groups on the study, but there's a very dramatic improvement in both stringent complete response and MRD negativity when the daratumumab is added into the RVD backbone. The progression-free and overall survival data are still immature, and we don't have any differences at this point, but both groups are doing incredibly well. And to be perfectly honest with you, I'd be particularly given, you know, what the Emory group has shown with regards to progression-free survival, particularly for standard-risk patients who get RVD-based therapy in a transplant setting, it's going to take a long time to see differences in progression-free survival emerge. So I think that the depth of response data are very compelling. One of the arguments against doing this is people say, well, what am I going to use at the time of relapse? I would argue that the overwhelming majority of patients will relapse well after their last dose of daratumumab and will be candidates for CD38 monoclonal antibody-based approaches at relapse. When you look at progression-free survival 2 in the MAIA study, which was DRD versus RD, or in the Alcyone study, which was MPV with or without DARA, PFS2 was better in the DARA arms in both studies, which suggests that you're not shooting yourself in the foot by putting your best foot forward at the beginning. And in fact, in the Alcyone study, we do now have a statistically significant, and I would argue clinically significant, improvement in overall survival as well. The DRVD regimen is now NCCN guideline approved for frontline therapy, and that's made it a lot easier to use outside of the context of a study. So I'm definitely a proponent of using it in the frontline setting for transplant-eligible patients.
So final question related to Dr. Morgenstein's case is the issue, and again, almost everybody asks this question, Sergio, in terms of sub-Q DARA. And of course, Pete and Jonathan have really made major contributions to that. But I'm just kind of curious from your point of view, what your view is of sub-Q DARA. Are you using it in everybody, Sergio, or selectively?
So we're trying now to use it in everybody. There are patients who, particularly if they're on blood thinners and they have very thin subcutaneous tissue, they develop severe bruising and they've actually requested to go back to infusions because of the bruising abnormalities. But I can tell you, or there are some patients who actually just like being able to be in the infusion suite for a couple of hours. They usually coincide with my clinic visits, so I go and see them there so they don't have to wait for me. But for most patients, I think sub-Q has been a blessing because it allows them to get in and out of the infusion center very quickly. And now patients are asking when they can self-administer, but that's another story.
So I want to bring up another case. So this was Dr. Gupta had a 70-year-old woman who relapsed after receiving bortezomib, cyclophosphamide, dexamethasone. She had some compromised renal function and then got DARA, POM, and DEX. And there were a couple of questions that she had that I wanted to ask Jonathan about. First, the issue of upfront management of patients with compromised renal function. Where are we with that today, Jonathan?
So there was a very nice study, it was published in JCO, that patients presenting with acute kidney injury comparing bortezomib dex versus bortezomib cyclophosphamide dex, and there was no benefit to the use of cyclophosphamide. And so our standard right now is bortezomib dexamethasone. And a lot of times these patients are hospitalized. And so the other thing that we've done with these patients, we have a clinical trial that is looking at, especially these hospitalized patients, giving daratumumab plus bortezomib dexamethasone. And so I think now with daratumumab approved up front, these patients, I try to get them as quickly as possible to maybe do bortezomib dexamethasone in the hospital. And if they can't get on the study, then add daratumumab to these patients to get that rapid response. The key to long-term improvement to renal function is that early response, presuming the patient's renal dysfunction is related to CAS nephropathy, which is the most common cause of renal dysfunction related to newly diagnosed myeloma.
So are you using a DARA in that situation outside of trial setting in patients with compromised renal function, Jonathan?
We are. We are using daratumumab. And then what would happen is, assuming the renal function gets better in the first month, then going to the Griffin regimen, Dara RVD. There have been situations where we use, while it's a drug we rarely use anymore, but we've used it for a long time, use the Cassiopeia regimen, is use Dara VTD. And periodically we've used Dara VTD until their renal function improves, and then switch to the Griffin regimen with Dara RVD.
So, Pete, this patient of Dr. Goop's renal function returned. However, unfortunately, she actually refused transplant, but then she relapsed about a year and a half later. She actually got DARA, POM, and DEX. But maybe you can talk a little bit about how you think through initial relapse in patients who start out with, let's say, VRD, and then also how you think it through in patients who get, for example, the Griffin approach.
So the first thing that I look at when I'm trying to make a decision about treatment of relapsed refractory myeloma patients is what drugs that they've seen previously, and in particular, what drugs, if any, they're refractory to at the time that you're needing to change therapy. And it sounds like in this particular case, it doesn't sound like the patient was on lenalidomide maintenance therapy at the time of their first relapse. So you really have a wealth of options to use in this particular space. You've got four different lenalidomide dex triplets that are approved in this space, with Dara-Lendex and Carfilzomib-Lendex performing the best of those studies. You've got four different Bortezomib-Dex regimens available in this space as well. This is a scenario, again, in the absence of any refractoriness to previous agents, a Dara-Lendex, or as in this case, a Dara-Pom-Dex strategy makes a lot of sense. Beyond that, if I'm still having to choose between a large number of different regimens, then you can look at what the patient experienced with their prior therapy. How did they do from a side effect perspective? Do they have any other comorbidities that may impact a particular agent? So, for example, if they have significant systolic congestive heart failure from previous myocardial infarctions, you may want to tread cautiously with a carfilzomib-based approach, for example. If the patient has significant lingering neuropathy with pain from prior bortezomib-based induction, you're probably going to want to avoid a bortezomib-based regimen in that space as well. But I think that the choice of Dara-Pom-Dex in this setting is perfectly appropriate. And assuming that they had not progressed on len maintenance, Dara-Lendex would have been a very appropriate strategy as well, with a phase 3 study showing a median progression-free survival of 44 and a half months with that triplet in the relapse space.
So again, Pete, just kind of curious whether elotuzumab fits in your menu at some point nowadays.
I think that the use of elotuzumab has become increasingly challenging over the course of time. I think that if someone has developed CD38 antibody refractoriness earlier in their disease course, it's not common to see that in the frontline setting for the reasons that I mentioned before, but you are seeing more Dara use in first relapse. So for those patients that would be a good candidate for a POM-based triplet and has CD38 antibody refractory disease, I think that there still is a role for elotuzumab, pomalidomide, dexamethasone in that particular space. There are some concerns that the NK cell depletion with the CD38 antibody could negatively impact the efficacy of an elotuzumab-based approach. That hasn't been proven in clinical trials, but certainly is a theoretical concern. So ideally, if the CD38 refractoriness occurred a couple of lines of therapy prior, that would be the ideal circumstance. But certainly at least a 3 to 6 month washout from the CD38 antibody before you do it. Otherwise, the role of elotuzumab in multiple myeloma, I think, is very limited.
So I want to bring up another case. This one was actually presented to Sergio. So a young patient, 40 years old, and unfortunately presents with a del17p T414, presents with lower back pain, extensive hypermetabolic lytic lesions, as you can see. His marrow showed 60% plasma cells. He actually got VCD and Dara, then BRD. And he actually had a stringent CR, but flow cytometry was positive. And there were a number of questions that he had. And I'll just start with you, Sergio, and then we'll get second opinions from your colleagues here. What are your thoughts about allogeneic transplant in the first-line setting for a patient like this? Particularly, he brings up CD34 cell-selected allogeneic, which I guess he's involved with some trials that are maybe related, are related, I think, to what you're doing at Memorial. Any thoughts about that, Sergio?
So I think this was a challenging situation that presents itself not infrequently. What do we do with a young patient with aggressive disease, with high-risk disease? And you're 40 years old. You have supposedly a life expectancy of 50 years. And with high-risk myeloma, even with the best drugs that we have available today, these patients will eventually relapse, and some of them relapse very early. We do have two large studies that now have very long-term follow-up comparing allogeneic upfront to autologous upfront. Most of them donor versus no donor design, so not really randomized trials, just a biological randomization. And the study shows that long-term follow-up for the auto-allo versus auto-auto from the CTN study, 20% of people who had high-risk disease and were transplanted upfront with an allogeneic transplant with a reduced intensity regimen were still alive without progression, as opposed to less than 7% for the patients who had a tandem auto. Now, this is a study that's now more than 10 years having been done. The question is, will allo be better now with the new drugs, or do the new drugs actually abrogate any of the benefit you would have gotten with an allo? And we don't know that. If this patient comes to my office, I have a long conversation with them. We have a clinical trial for such a patient. Looking at the ways we try to do an allogeneic transplant is to totally abrogate graft versus host disease. Graft versus host disease is not a good disease to have. It affects quality and quantity of life. CD34 selection platform that was pioneered in myeloma by Gunter Koenig, we've shown a very low risk of graft versus host disease. We're improving that platform even further. And as a part, we also think that post allogeneic transplant, people need some form of continued treatment. We think that many of the upcoming immunotherapies, the bispecific as the CAR T cells, will probably work even better in a allogeneic platform because the immune systems of these patients are better. But I think it's still an open question. But I mean, this young patient with high risk disease, if he decides that he doesn't want an allo up front, we would probably recommend a tandem auto followed by combined maintenance therapy, probably with four drugs. And then eventually after 2 years, we would reduce the maintenance. If he relapses, though, then we would strongly encourage him to do an allogeneic transplant. We have a clinical trial that we are proposing to use a CAR T cell once ide-cel becomes commercially available as a consolidation for an allogeneic transplant done in patients with multiply relapsed disease. And actually, in patients with multiply relapsed disease, particularly young patients, the only way to achieve long-term disease control is through an allogeneic transplant.
So a second opinion from Jonathan.
But it should be done in the context of a clinical trial.
So second opinion from Jonathan on what Sergio just said, both about allo, but also about tandem transplant. And in general, how are you approaching, say, a del-17P patient who's not 40, more typical patient who's 65 or 70, Jonathan?
So we've moved away from allo transplant. And I think Sergio very clearly described the clinical trial data and noted that it was really done before all of our new therapies. And the one could debate whether new therapies would be additions to allo or they wouldn't make the same additions that we're seeing in the non-allo setting. So we've moved away from allo transplant, and we have current clinical trials for a patient exactly like this, looking at early upfront CAR T-cell therapy. I think that's going to be a big push. The question of early auto followed by consolidation CAR T-cell therapy is a question that we're going to be asking in this patient population. But outside of this patient, outside of a clinical trial, what we're currently doing is four-drug induction therapy followed by a single autologous transplant. And I guess one could argue if you achieve MRD negativity, yes, we know that's not a cure, but if you achieve an MRD negativity with four-drug induction therapy and single auto transplant, do you really gain significantly from a second autologous transplant? And then followed by an aggressive, prolonged, at least three-drug maintenance approach. We haven't, outside of the context of a clinical trial or inside a clinical trial, looked at four-drug prolonged maintenance. And again, the study that this patient would go on at our site would be a combination of carfilzomib, pomalidomide, dexamethasone. Outside the clinical trial, we would, in a large part, recommend carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, assuming they had a major response to induction therapy.
So I want to get into a couple other issues in the relapse setting. And Pete, this is a case of Dr. Morgenstein's, a 64-year-old patient who started out with RBD, tandem transplant, KRD, a Darapom Dex, and he has a T1114 translocation. So he has a whole bunch of questions, but one question is the role of venetoclax, but also sort of the role of, let's say, patients have already had a proteasome inhibitor, they've already had anti-CD38, they've had an IMiD, how you think through the various options that are out there right now, including belantamab, selinexor, and CAR T therapy. So Pete, maybe we can start out with the 1114 and venetoclax. When you start thinking about venetoclax, what your experience is with it?
And Jonathan actually has done a lot of the work with venetoclax and the T1114 positive patients. But there's absolutely no question that that group of myeloma patients, which represents approximately 15% of the total myeloma population, has a myeloma that's more BCL2 dependent than the other 85% of patients out there. And there was a very nice initial phase 1 study that showed an approximate 40% response rate to venetoclax monotherapy for 1114 positive patients. And then Jonathan subsequently published data with the combination of venetoclax and dexamethasone for the 1114 positive patients with response rates of approximately 50%. Interestingly, the Emory group has actually shown very nice data that dexamethasone, while oftentimes patients are refractory to it at the point at which venetoclax is being considered, but the dexamethasone, at least in preclinical models, tends to make myeloma more BCL2 dependent. So it may actually have some sensitizing effects to the venetoclax. So I would say for a T1114 positive patient, if they have triple class refractory disease, so for example, in this particular case, if that patient starts progressing on their Darapalm Dex, I would definitely be reaching for venetoclax dexamethasone in that particular patient. And I'm now at a point at which where I'm starting to think about it actually a bit earlier in lines of relapse. And there's a couple of different triplets, which I think have performed very well in the 1114 positive patient population, granted relatively small numbers of patients. There's nice data from combining daratumumab with venetoclax and dexamethasone with a response rate approaching 100%, all of which are very good partial responses or better. There's also very good data in the 1114 positive patients with carfilzomib, venetoclax, dexamethasone. So in first and second relapse, I'm starting to think about a venetoclax-based triplet in that group of patients.
So, Jonathan, I'd love to get your take on venetoclax, where you see it today, where you see it heading. And also, I think it was in the Bellini trial that they talked about, I think it was a BCL2 assay, that in addition to the 1114 patients, there were others who had, quote, a positive BCL2 assay. So where are we also in terms of that type of assay?
So in the Bellini trial, a trial of all comers showed that if you, in all comers, there was a decrease in survival. And so if you look at just the 1114 patient population, while the numbers are very small and the error bars around the hazard ratio are very wide, it's very clear that that's the subset of patients that I would consider using venetoclax. I think it's really critical at this point to only use venetoclax in 1114 patient, in the 1114 patient population. And that represents, as Pete said, probably somewhere in the 15, possibly 20% of patients. You could increase that percent of patients to probably around 30% in those patients who have high BCL2. We have not incorporated that into our standard practice, and we have really just stuck with 1114. And I think because of the Bellini data, the decrease in survival from the Bellini data perspective, I think it's really critical that at least until we confirm that venetoclax is going to be safe in the 1114 patient population, I'm not expanding my group of patients outside 1114. We have some in-house assays where we can demonstrate in a small additional subset of patients significant sensitivity. We just published a very nice work done by one of our physician scientists who's looked at a variety of cell surface markers and can show a B cell phenotype. And we think, and these are markers that are on routine flow cytometry, and we think we're going to be able in the future identify those patients who are going to be venetoclax sensitive by looking at this immunophenotypic B cell phenotype.
So, Sergio, Dr. Morgenstein, again, brings up the same question you hear from all oncologists. When you get out in that space beyond proteasome inhibitors, anti-CD38 and Len, what comes first? How do you sequence it? How do you change the sequence based on the type of patient? And obviously, belantamab is now a consideration. People have a lot of questions about the ocular issues there. Dr. Morgenstein brought that up, but also the issue of selinexor. And again, the issue that everybody brings up with selinexor, of course, is the toxicity. So first, just in terms of in general, how you figure out which direction you're going in by specifics along with CAR T or trial options, but sometimes trial is clearly the best option for a patient. How do you think this through, Sergio?
So just to summarize, so what do you do with the patient who's triple refractory and penta exposed? And I think Pete surmised it is, look, you really, we have to look at the whole picture. How is the patient relapsing? Is this an aggressive relapse with extramedullary presentation, high LDH, or is this a biochemical escape where just the paraprotein's coming up? With all patients who are relapsing, we actually do full restaging with bone marrow and PETs. We send the bone marrow for next generation sequencing and mutational analysis, partly because there are sometimes mutations that can be targeted. We are participating in the My Drug with the MMRF. So I think there are, and sometimes some of these agents are agents that you can do off trial if the patient doesn't want to participate in a clinical trial. Obviously, if the patient has an 1114 translocation, venetoclax is high on our list. Well, if a patient refuses to participate in a clinical trial, it is, let's say, is if the patient has an aggressive relapse, this is a patient who we go back to polychemotherapy. The etoposide platinum combinations have shown a response rate of 50% in this patient population, but it really is a bridge to something else. Because these patients, if you, with etoposide platinum combinations or anthracycline platinum combinations or C platinum combinations, you'll probably get about a 6-month remission in a patient. We do consider patients candidates for second transplants. High-dose melphalan is a drug that they haven't seen in a lot of times, and we can get patients to have, again, really in the context of a clinical trial, we use high-dose melphalan to get patients in a deep remission and then try to put them on trials with innovative maintenance strategies or maintenance combinations. Selinexor is an interesting drug. If you look at the data from Mount Sinai, when A.J. Cherry's presented it, they have a response rate of 50%, and many of their patients can stay on drug for many months. But they have a very organized, nurse-driven, supportive care strategy with antiemetics, antidepressant, appetite stimulants. They bring the patients in initially once or twice a week for hydration. And they actually are constantly monitoring the patient to be able to titrate the dose of the drug. And with this strategy, they've actually shown that selinexor can be a very effective agent in the patients who are triple refractory and PET exposed. Belantamab is a new addition. It's an antibody drug conjugate as a single agent. It has significant activity in the triple refractory PET exposed, but ocular side effects are a significant problem. You need to have 40% of people have to stop the drug or delay the drug because of keratopathy. It does resolve. In some patients, we can restart the rechallenge the patients with the drug and continue it at a what we'll call an attenuated pace. But it is a challenging drug to give sometimes because of the keratopathy. I think eventually this year, hopefully, we will have Ide-cel commercially available. And then it's a question of how do we optimize Ide-cel? What's the best way to bridge these patients? I think most important things that community physicians should remember is to always ask their patients, do they have cells stored? I mean, the group at Case Western showed that only 20% of people who have cells stored for a subsequent transplant actually use them. And we're trying to make a case that this is a major resource and high-dose melphalan works in the multiply relapse setting. And we actually will have protocols not only with high-dose melphalan, but with combinations and with a new formulation of melflufen that is being explored in the high-dose setting.
Interesting. So, Jonathan, your take, particularly on selinexor and belantamab, one question that a lot of people have about belamaf is whether you can use CAR-T before it, whether you can use CAR-T after it, BCMA versus BCMA, and also your clinical experience with belantamab, both in terms of the tolerability issues that Sergio referred to, but also in terms of efficacy.
I think from getting to the question of BCMA, while most of the studies have excluded prior BCMA therapy. We're now getting more and more studies that don't exclude them. And the reality is, while we just had a nice presentation and subsequent publication showing that there can be BCMA loss as a cause of refractoriness or relapse after BCMA-targeted CAR T-cell therapy, the majority of relapses after or refractoriness to belantamab, but relapse after belantamab and refractoriness to any BCMA target therapy is not going to be loss of BCMA. I'm not saying everybody, but the majority. And so I think it's very reasonable to look at BCMA targeted, at sequential BCMA targeted therapies, possibly with some other therapy in between. And I think a nice tool that we could possibly use in the future, and I don't think it's readily available to us now, is measuring soluble BCMA. If a patient has progressive myeloma and rising BCMA, that patient is potentially a BCMA target. And the question is, where have we used it? We're still, while there's significant amount of data out there with combination therapy that's been presented at meetings with either bortezomib, lenalidomide, and now more targeted combination therapy, we're still using in the patient population that Sergio mentioned, that triple class refractory and penta or six exposed therapies. And we see as a single agent 30 to 40% response rate. The patients who respond have an impressive duration of response approaching 1 year. And I think more than the keratopathy being such a problem, it's really the logistics. You really have to have a well-coordinated system with an ophthalmologist so that you can monitor. But in a large part, if a patient's responding to therapy, you have to hold a dose or two because of the keratopathy. Once it resolves, often the patients remain in remission and that you can treat subsequently down the line. So we have a lot of experience based on clinical trials and have really put this into that triple class refractory outside of the clinical trial setting.
Any comments on the quality of responses that you see with Belamaf, Jonathan?
So the quality responses are across the board. And I think the key to the quality of response is that, as I mentioned, the duration of response. So while it's less than half the patients, it's in the 30 to 40% range, you know it's their deep responses because of the duration of response, 11 to 12 months duration of response. As a single agent, we're not seeing a significant number of, while you can happen, a significant number of CRs or MRD negativity. We're not seeing that. But I think just like we've seen with many other drugs in myeloma, Belamaf isn't going to be primarily a single agent. It's going to be used in combinations. And then we're going to see those deep responses, including MRD negativity.
So Pete, again, your experience with both Belamaf, also selinexor, and how you found its tolerability. One of the things I started to hear from a lot of people is that when you combine it, you know, for example, the bortezomib, and you use it once a week, you see a lot better tolerability. So your experience with both of those drugs, Pete?
I think with regards to belantamab mafodotin, our clinical experience very much mirrors the phase 2 DREAM 2 study that led to the accelerated approval of that agent in triple class refractory patients. So about a third of patients, or 30% of patients, will respond. And to Jonathan's point, the median duration of response was 11 months. And importantly, the median duration of response to ide-cel was actually 11 months as well. So the overall response rate is not as high with belantamab mafodotin as it is with ide-cel, but for those that do respond, the durability of responses are actually quite similar. Were it not for the keratopathy, I think belantamab mafodotin is an incredibly well-tolerated agent. So I think if we can wrap our brains around the mechanism of action of the toxicity and ways to mitigate that toxicity, I think it has a very promising future, particularly in combination therapy. I do think that the dosing schedule matters, and the fact that doses need to be delayed so frequently, I think, screams to us that once every 3 week dosing is not appropriate. And it is a drug with a half-life of approximately 14 days. So when you're dosing it every 3 weeks, there is an accumulation that occurs. So the corneas probably don't have enough time to recover. So I think a less frequent dosing strategy, particularly in a combination therapy, is the way forward with belantamab. And to that regard, our colleague Suzanne Trudell presented a very nice preliminary data with the belantamab, pomalidomide, dexamethasone triplet in relapsed refractory multiple myeloma at December's ASH. with incredible response rates of approaching 80%, most of which were very good partial responses and complete responses. So I think that that will be the path forward. With regards to selinexor, I think its approval for twice weekly dosing in combination with dexamethasone is a no-go from a toxicity perspective. Severe constitutional and gastrointestinal toxicity with that dose and dose schedule, and significant cytopenias, particularly thrombocytopenia as well. There's no question that the once weekly dosing platform is far better tolerated. And that's also been very nicely demonstrated in the Boston trial, which compared bortezomib dexamethasone to selinexor bortezomib dexamethasone. And in that study, they used a weekly dosing strategy with the selinexor. And interestingly, they used a less intensive bortezomib dosing strategy as well in the triplet arm, where the bortezomib was only given weekly, whereas in the bortezomib dex doublet arm, it was given in standard fashion of twice weekly on a three-week cycle. So they were actually able to back off on the bortezomib schedule in the triplet arm and still have an improvement in progression-free survival. So I think selinexor is an interesting drug. It has a very distinct mechanism of action relative to anything else that we use in multiple myeloma. Its path forward is, again, in combination strategies, and the once-weekly dosing platform is definitely the way to go there.
So final topic, CAR-T. Sergio, I'm curious, first of all, whether at this point there's any way you can differentiate the various products that are being tested, both in terms of efficacy and tolerability issues.
So I'm going to punt that one. I think we all have our speculations based on what we're seeing with the data that's been presented in ASH about whether one product might have more durable remissions. We do know, and I can comment, that the toxicity profile is different. Ide-cel gives CRS and neurotoxicity much earlier in the course after infusion versus cilta-cel, which actually the median time to CRS and to neurotoxicity was 4 to 5 days versus 1 to 2 days for ide-cel. I think time will tell whether one product is better than another, because these products are cellular therapies. Outcomes will have to be reported, or should be reported, to the registry, and eventually we'll be able to see. If you fail one, will you respond to the other? Remember, they're different constructs. As Jonathan alluded to, BCMA loss might not be the most common mechanism of resistance. It probably has to do with changes in the microenvironment or development of an immune suppressant milieu that doesn't affect the way the CAR T works, or enhance disappearance of CAR T cells. I think for both products, the biggest challenge is what happens when the T-cell engagers come available. I mean, T-cell engagers will be off the shelf. So as opposed to having to refer somebody for a CAR T-cell therapy, the community oncologist can simply prescribe a T-cell engager. We are now just starting the cohorts of patients who will have received a BCMA-targeted therapy to get a BCMA CAR T. Most of these patients will have received belantamab. One would assume that probably the best combo is to give the T-cell engager with a CAR T-cell, because that way the antibody will take the CAR T-cell to where the myeloma is. But these are studies that are currently being planned. But to your question, I think at this time we cannot say that one product is better than another. They will probably never be compared head-to-head. But I think with experience, we will figure out whether there is a leading horse there.
So, Jonathan, one of the obvious observations that's been made is it kind of looks like when you compare it to CD19, for example, in lymphoma, diffuse large B-cell, you see kind of a shoulder on the curve, and it looks like maybe some of these people are getting cured. At this point, it kind of doesn't look like that with CAR-T. Curious what your thoughts are about it. The issue has been brought up of the fact that their basic immune system by the time they're getting treated is so beat up that maybe that's an issue. Maybe if you treated these patients earlier, you get better results. Any thoughts?
I was talking to a patient and having this exact discussion today. When CAR T cells were first being looked at in myeloma, we were very excited that we were going to be in the same situation, what you just described, the plateau and the curve in lymphoma and ALL. And then we saw the first data that came out, and the data looked good in that it was a high response rate and progression-free survival approaching a year. It looked bad in that the progression-free survival curve looked like every progression-free survival curve we've ever seen in myeloma, which was a straight line down. And so I think you're exactly, and so ultimately myeloma remains myeloma, and using CAR T cells after three lines of therapy or fifth line therapy is not going to be a curative strategy. The question is that can the current CAR T cells be a curative strategy in a different place in myeloma? Should we be collecting T cells earlier when they have less prior therapy? Should we be collecting T cells prior to autologous transplant so they haven't been impacted by high-dose alkylating agent therapy? Is CAR T-cell therapy going to be effective in a minimal residual disease setting, similar to how CAR T-cell is effective in minimal residual disease with ALL? These are all questions that we don't know, but I think right now in the relapse refractory setting, CAR T-cell, while very effective and potentially effective for a long period of time, is not curative. And I'm really looking forward to bringing it up earlier. I'm not sure we're going to be curative, but maybe with some novel ideas, including ones mentioned by Sergio, these therapies can be associated with prolonged remissions and deep responses.
So final comment from Pete. Any thoughts about where you think we're heading? Do you think maybe these bispecifics are going to actually replace CAR T in 3-4 years from now, we're not going to be using it?
I think that the data from the bispecific trials are a little bit earlier on as far as median duration follow-up relative to at least the initial CAR T products that have been presented at numerous meetings in the past. I know that that's a hazardous thing to do. But I would also argue that the bispecific antibody response rates are very close to what you see with the CAR T cells. I think whether there's differences in depth of response remains to be seen. It's clear that the majority of patients who get BCMA-targeted CAR T cell therapy or bispecific antibody therapy achieve at least a VGPR and a lot of DRs as well, many of which are MRD negative. So I think really the big question is, what's going to be the progression-free survival and median duration of follow-up with these bispecific antibodies like teclistamab, for example, and there's many that are currently in development and that were presented at last year's ASH. I think that if the longitudinal outcomes are similar to what we're seeing with CAR T cells, the CAR T cells are going to be in jeopardy unless these next generation CAR T platforms, these armored CAR T cells, et cetera, move the needle forward even further.
Subsequent to this recording, on March 26, 2021, the FDA approved idacaptogene voleucel for the treatment of adults with relapsed or refractory multiple myeloma after 4 more lines of therapy, including an immunomodulatory agent, a proteasome inhibitor, and an anti-CD38 monoclonal antibody. Also, on February 26, 2021, the FDA granted accelerated approval to melphalan flufenamide in combination with dexamethasone for adults with relapsed or refractory multiple myeloma who've received at least 4 prior lines of therapy and whose disease is refractory to at least 1 proteasome inhibitor, 1 immunomodulatory agent, and 1 CD38-directed monoclonal antibody. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty and our presenting general medical oncologist, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Meet the Professors.